Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Welcome back to Sports Talk here on the Big 870. Mike DeTellier along with Charlie Long in studio. 5:45, Steve Geller will join us for our triple option feature. 5:20, one of our top guests that we have on weekly, Odyssey NFL insider Mark Schlereth. Charlie, I was telling you this. Every once in a while, man, we get a really, really good text. Now, sometimes we get some lulus, but man, this was a really good question from 5,500. Charlie and Mike, I'm just curious, with the transfer portal being prominent now, how big is National Signing Day? Feels like the transfer portal is becoming more of a bigger deal than high school signing day. I think it's still a huge deal. National Signing Day for high school kids. But I talked to a college head coach today that told me, I think they've done a study that you lose 9 players you sign. Let's say if you have a class of 24, you lose 9 within the first 2 years. So if you've got 9 coming out of that 24, you've lost more than a third of the guys within 2 years. Some of them aren't going to make it. Some will. So I think in years past, National Signing Day was the do-all. That's how you built a program. Every once in a while, you got, you know, a grad transfer that could come in and play for a year or two that had already graduated from another school. Today, the transfer portal now is significant because you have to look at it similar to the NFL draft, where when you look at an offseason, it used to be just look at the draft. Now it's the draft, which you lost in free agency, which you gain. In college football, it's what you get high school-wise and also what you lose in the portal, what you gain in the portal. Very good question.
Yes.
It's not a bigger deal than the high school recruits, but it is close to, I think, almost being on a par with it at this stage.
And it kind of, to your point, Mike, lessening the impact of National Signing Day because of how important the transfer portal has become. I mean, we have a really good gauge on it. Just look at LSU. And for the first 3 years Brian Kelly was in Baton Rouge, he kept preaching, we're going to build through the high school ranks. We're going to build through the high school ranks. They go 8-4 this year, and the first thing that he's saying in the post-game presser, oh, we're going to be aggressive in the transfer portal. We're going to be, you know, targeting all these pieces. I think he even said, Mike, that they're going to have one of the biggest transfer portal classes in the country. So, I don't know, maybe Coach Kelly's starting to learn, yeah, you got to actually pay attention to the transfer portal if you want to be competing in college football nowadays. So, yeah, it is a really good question. I think it lessens the impact slightly because there is that new kind of mode of transfer portal players that hop from school to school. And it's, by all accounts, this offseason, everything that you hear from, you know, commissioners and ADs, they all recognize how messy it's going to be just because of how, like, the volume of players. Not even necessarily the quality. The quality is also there, but the volume of players that are entering the transfer portal looking for, you know, who's going to pay them the big bucks. So it's, you know, we've said it a lot of times, Mike, the genie's out the bottle. It's not getting put back anytime soon.
Never.
The transfer portal is a complete mess right now, but, you know, It's to the victor goes the spoils, right? Whichever team is able to get those top pieces out of the portal, I mean, they're impact players that you can add on your roster for the next season.
No question about it, Charlie. I think it lessens it some, but I think what it does is enhance what you're going to do in the transfer portal.
Right.
And that's where you can sort of look at certain spots. If I'm LSU, man, the safety position this year was absolutely lousy. You need help across the defensive tackle grouping that you have. You look at wide receiver now, if, you know, Kyren's going to come out, and
TJ's
now
gone.
You lose C.J. Daniels, you don't have a lot of guys there. Numbers-wise, you going to play a true freshman? Yeah. Now, every once in a while, you might have a stud. Ryan Williams was that for Alabama.
Oh, yeah.
But even Jefferson and Jamar, as great as they weren't superstars as freshmen. Sophomore is a different story. So there are bits and pieces there that you can put together. And I just think when Brian made that comment, I told you, he doesn't understand the real world.
Yeah.
It's changing in front of you that transfer portal is going to be a major part of you building a program. You can't just dismiss it and say, oh, we're just going to build with high school kids. It's not going to work that way.
It's an old school way of thinking in a new world. You know what I mean, Mike? So, you know, it's good to hear that Coach Kelly is recognizing that that was a mistake and that they're going to be quote-unquote aggressive in the transfer portal this year because, as you're mentioning, there's multiple positions they have to address.
Yeah, it's just not one.
It's safety, as you mentioned. It's wide receiver, as you mentioned. Defensive line, which was already a patchwork this past year, and they swung and missed on multiple defensive tackles, and, you know, you got what you got on the defensive line. They're going to have to do it again this year. And, I mean, if you're expecting a big class of transfer portal pieces, that's how you kind of plug the holes. That's how you're looking at this upcoming 2025 roster and future rosters. You're looking at next year, okay, we need a player here at this position. Let's hop in the portal and get, you know, one of the top guys. So
yeah, because every once in a while you'll find a guy like Will Campbell that can come. He can play
as a true freshman.
Emory Jones, he didn't start game one, but he got to play a lot as a true freshman. Okay, that's going to happen now and then. Okay, what happened when LSU lost one of their offensive guards and you played the kid from Georgia?
Yeah, Dellinger, and, you know, got injured. It was Mobenga who filled
in.
Oh,
my God.
Yeah, he got beat like a drum.
He was overwhelmed by it. He got put in a bad spot. He was overwhelmed. And then you had a redshirt freshman center. Now, he's never played the center position in high school. They moved him from guard to center. You saw the growing pains with him. So anybody that tells you, oh, play the 18-year-old freshman. Yeah, every once in a while you got a Will Campbell. But look what happened with a redshirt freshman and DJ, and Mobenga comes in there and play. You had some serious issues.
It's not the norm. I mean, that's the point that you're making, Mike, and you're 100% right. Like, you're not going to have, you know, these first-round prospects walking in as 18-year-olds every single year. It's not normal. Like, sure, you'll find studs here and there, these five stars that are, you know, college ready right off the bat. But at the same time, I mean, developing the players out of the high school ranks has been important, and being able to plug those holes with guys that have already played college snaps, I think, is the way to do it.
The other thing, too, is we live in a state that doesn't produce a lot of offensive tackles. And so you're going to have to go somewhere else. Outside the state of Louisiana. Now, Will Campbell and Emory were both from Louisiana, but, you know, that was sort of the lightning strike.
That's unusual, Mike.
Yeah, and he didn't want to wait.
Right.
He didn't want to wait, and he didn't want to move to guard. Yeah. That was the other part about it. When they talked to him about it, he was, oh, no, I want to play tackle. Tennessee gave him that opportunity and, you know, made it worth his while, so to speak, and he started right off the bat for the Volunteers.
Lance Hurd.
Yeah, Lance was a really good football player, great prospect, and he went through the growing pains, too, because he really didn't have a lot of experience at LSU. We'll be back with more sports talk here on the Big 870 and our Odyssey NFL insider, Mark Schlereff, right after this break here on the Big 870 WWL. Welcome back to sports talk here on the Big 870. Mike Dettelia along with Charlie Long in studio. And on our Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line, we're joined by Odyssey NFL insider Mark Schlereff, host of the Stinkin' Truth podcast. Insider calls are brought to you by Hellman's Real Mayonnaise. May your game day be delicious. Mark, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. And before we get into maybe some Saints talk, last night was really something to watch. We'd watched Denver's defense all season long, and they had been the calling card for them. They had played terrific defense, and I thought last night they did a great job stopping the run. And then Jameis Winston hits the scene, and he completes 34 of his 58 passes for 497 yards, four touchdowns. And he put some tight window throws in there that were really impressive. And then it's the other part of Jameis that we've seen, too. Three interceptions, and two of them brought back for pick sixes. Vance Joseph's defense, has anybody played them? that well throwing the football against that defense this year?
No, not even close. And Jameis, you know, he's a national treasure. If he didn't exist, you ought to create him. The guy is just he's absolutely amazing. You know, and he's at post-game press conference saying he's going to pray to Jesus to fix his pick six issues. Like, I just love the dude. And he's one of those guys that everybody that you've ever talked to play with Jameis Winston loves him. Natural leader, guys gravitate towards him, all that stuff. But, you know, he will throw it into a team meeting. You mentioned it, 4 touchdown passes. He had 6 touchdown passes because he had 2 pick sixes. So, you know, he has had those issues in the past. Obviously, that's part of kind of his game. And listen, man, they did a great job. Now, that said, Levi Wallace had no business being on a football field last night. I don't know if he was hurt.
God.
I don't know what's going on. But, man, that guy couldn't cover anything. And so that part was disappointing. And Jerry Jeudy ran by him while he was standing still. So not a good matchup. And, you know, it's funny, there's all kinds of analytics stuff going on from, you know, from next gen and all that stuff, that when Pat Surtain was on him, like, I think he got 2 catches for like 20 some odd yards or something. But credit to the Cleveland Browns for getting him matched up on the other side, getting him matched up on Levi Wallace and, you know, Jameis Winston hitting guys. So It was an exciting game. Both threw a couple of interceptions. You know, one of them, great play by Ward, and you know, the other one, which was a tip ball that got picked off. The other one was a 2-man route, and he threw it to the right guy. It just didn't. It looked like the receiver almost quit running the route at first. And so anyhow, you look at the way it came out, and big win for the Broncos, sitting at 8-5 right now with their rookie quarterback and feeling like they figured things out.
Yeah, and for everybody that said, oh, Sean, he only got to be where he is because of Drew Brees. And listen, Sean would be first to admit it. Man, Drew Brees had a lot to do with my success. This was sort of his stick the middle finger to you and say, hey, listen, I'm winning with a rookie quarterback. What are you talking about? I can do that too. And I just think what Sean has done this year with a lot of guys most people don't even know. At wide receiver, at tight end, at running back. Mm-hmm. They have a no-name defense in a lot of different ways other than Surtain, and he's making it work. You got to give him his props. No matter what you want to think about him, man, he is making it work in Denver, and they got confidence in him.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, he's coached his butt off, and he's in that conversation of Coach of the Year. There's no question about that in my mind. And listen, man, there was nothing but criticism. You know, he got rid of Russ, and Russ didn't have a bad season, and this, that, and the other. And, you know, they're going to eat all this cap money, and they'll never be able to recover. Well, they're sitting at the 7th seed in the playoffs right now, charging. And, you know, they've got a comfortable lead over the next couple of, playoff potential teams. So, yeah, what they've been able to do with the rookie quarterback and, you know, the success they've had so far, it's a big-time performance by Sean Payton, his coaching staff. And so, you know, being a, you know, former Denver Bronco and spending a lot of my adult life there the last 27 years, it's exciting, man. It's really cool.
Mark, one of the things, I think you did the game, Carolina-Tampa Bay. And, yeah. Man, to watch that in Tampa Bay, and I give them credit, they fought back and ended up with the W. But I was really impressed with the Panthers. This team could have thrown the towel in, so to speak, on Dave Canales and what was happening at quarterback, and Bryce wasn't getting it done. And to watch how, man, hard they played, they had a spot, they kind of had them boxed in for a little while, they let them off the hook, and the Bucs ended up winning. But over the last 3 or 4 weeks, you got to be impressed with what Canales has done with that football team and the metamorphosis of Bryce Young at quarterback.
Yeah, no question. Playing hard, you know, teams that don't have anything to play for, that still play hard. And listen, man, Bryce Young, I've been benched before, man. It's humiliating to get benched. Humiliating. And, you know, to get benched in your second year and then to sit back and kind of relearn the offense, if you will, and do everything you can to give the scout team a look and prepare like you were starting and, You know, Bryce Young said to me, hey, man, I played, it was though I was playing the game from the sideline. And you know, the things that I learned from Andy Dalton and just kind of watching, sitting back, and, you know, obviously it was very beneficial to him. Has a better understanding of the offense, better understanding where his check down is. You know, and he's playing faster. He's like 1-2. If that's not open, get it to my check down. Don't just scramble for the sake of scrambling. Don't hold the football. If the first guy is open, the first read and progression, get it to him right now. Let him go out, make extra yards, and break a tackle or whatever. But he is playing that way right now. You know, still off a little bit on some of his deep throws down the sideline. He missed two or three of those where they weren't even close. Like, they didn't give the receiver a chance. They didn't give the receiver a chance to catch it. They didn't give the receiver a chance to draw a pass interference. Nothing. So those have to be better. But you're right, man. To watch him go from, like, NFL bust, completely incompetent, to going, wow, the kid is actually playing pretty well. Pretty amazing to watch that go down.
Mark, looking at the Saints and the Giants game this upcoming weekend, Mike and I talked about this. Dexter Lawrence for the Giants, he suffered that elbow injury on Thanksgiving against the Cowboys. Now he's been placed on the IR. It's season-ending for him, basically. But the season that he put up, I mean, the Saints caught a gigantic break here, not having to deal with this kind of beast on the interior. Dexter Lawrence had 9 sacks in the first 7 weeks of the season as a nose tackle. And, Mike, you talked about this as well yesterday on the Saints coaches show, that Pete Jenkins, legendary defensive line coach, said that he'd never seen someone that big move like that. So the Saints, you know, catching a big break here without Dexter Lawrence on that Giants defensive line.
Yeah, he is. I mean, that dude is special. And he is thick, big, explosive, athletic, like the whole nine yards. And you're not supposed to be that big and strong and still be able to rush the passer. So he can do both those things, you know, and defend the run. And, yeah, 100%. 100%. You know, I mean, but I will say this about the Giants. It's not like you've got a bunch of guys that you have to figure out how you're going to block them, right? It's not like you're going, oh, my gosh, how are we going to get this guy and this guy and this guy? There's really one guy that you got to take care of. Now, Thibodeau on the edge is, you know, had his moments, and Burns, who they traded for from Carolina, has had some moments, and, you know, and all that. But, you know, it's not like they're a great defensive unit. It's not like they're a great football team. So, yeah, the Saints caught a break because Dexter is really that guy. And now, you know, you're not afraid to go scat protection where you get, you know, all five guys, all five eligibles out in the route combination, because you're like, oh, we don't have to double. We can single team guys. So we can go 5-0 and single team guys and get everybody out and give our quarterback a bunch of options. So it just gives you another tool in the toolbox offensively to attack a defense with.
Insider Calls with Mark Slareff are brought to you by Hellman's Real Mayonnaise. You can purchase Hellman's at your local Walmart, Kroger, or grocery store to add extra deliciousness and creamy flavor to your game day dishes this football season. Mark, Saints, Rams, the Saints could not stop the run at all. And I think the Rams got five, you know, blocks of granite blocking for Kyron Williams and Blake Corum. And they averaged over 5 yards a touch rushing the ball. I think going into the game, Bob and I had talked about this, we were much more concerned about Stafford up against a depleted secondary, that he might take full advantage of that. But really what won them the game was their ability to control the clock and run the football with both Kerm and with Kyron Williams. And, okay, most people would have a difficult time telling you more than one offensive lineman for the Rams today.
Yeah, no, well, there's no question about that. I think one of the things that's really interesting about Sean McVay is, you know, he always gives you this, one of his lines whenever you talk to him is the illusion of complexity, right? All the motions and all the wide receivers and everything else. And if you go back to his core is built in the Mike Shanahan offense. We're going to run it down your throat. And so that's always the first priority. Let's just run the football. Let's run it as much as we can. And let's give you a lot of things to think about, a lot of things to defend, and then let's run it. The other thing is they get a lot of favorable matchups because they run it out of 11 personnel. So they use multiple three wide receivers. And then Puka Nacua and Cooper Kupp are really essentially tight ends in a lot of the things they do. And they block like tight ends. So what ends up happening is the defense is you play nickel or dime. So you're getting small bodies in there. You're playing, if you're playing nickel, you're playing with two linebackers. If you're playing dime, you're playing with one linebacker. And so they get a lot of small bodies in there, and then they just beat you up with those receivers that I talked about. But their offensive line blocking defensive backs, they're actually playing the linebacker positions. And so they get some real favorable matchups, and they can wear your butt down just doing that. And then those running backs, especially Kyren Williams, that dude runs hard, man. He tries to run people over. So, yeah, it's kind of one of their strategies, and, you know, they executed exceptionally well against the Saints, obviously.
Mark, looking at the Giants, they're 2-10 this year. I mean, we don't even know if they're starting Tommy DeVito or, you know, Drew Lock or whoever.
Does it matter?
No, it doesn't matter at all. But my point is, my question for you, Brian Daboll and Joe Shane. Yep. I mean, they both make the hop over from Buffalo back in 2022, and I think Joe Shane's tenure has been pretty tumultuous, you would say. I mean, just ask Giants fans that get to watch Saquon Barkley every weekend in Philadelphia and, you know, looking at Daniel Jones now on the street, or he's in Minnesota now, my apologies. But you get my point here. It's been not the greatest tenure for Joe Shane early on. But looking at Brian Daboll, I want your thoughts on him because, you know, that first year he gets them to the playoffs and they beat Minnesota in the wild card round before losing to Philly, a better team. But at the same time, it almost kind of felt like a curse because at that point, I think that's the reason they maybe paid Daniel Jones that type of contract. And obviously that's gone completely south quickly. And just kind of the buzz about their job security for both of them. Brian Daboll as head coach and then Joe Shane as GM of the Giants.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the whole way they handled Daniel Jones is a joke. And they handled the backup. I'd get benching him. You're going to bench him. That's fine. That doesn't bother me. But when you bench him, and then the guy who played backup quarterback for you for 11 weeks in a row that would have gone in if Daniel Jones gets hurt, gets usurped in the pecking order by your third-team quarterback who doesn't take reps during the week because your second-teamer gets them, both as the second-team quarterback and as the scout-team quarterback, then all of a sudden he gets – you hand him the job – because his name is Tommy Cutlets and he resonates with Giants fans. So you give him the job and you usurp the backup quarterback because your excuse is, well, he knows the offense better. Well, if he knew the offense better, he would have been your backup quarterback. Like that whole thing is such a debacle and it's an absolute clown show and it's embarrassing. And if I was a player in that organization and I was sitting in that locker room, I wouldn't trust anybody within the organization that runs it as far as I could throw them. And Dable's a friend of mine. And I just look at that and I don't know if that comes from Joe Shane. I don't know if it comes from Daboll. I don't know if it comes from the owner. But it's a clown show. And, you know, and they come out and play after that, you know, and they're playing against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And they just absolutely get throttled in that game.
They quit in that game,
30-7.
They quit in that game. I mean, you could see them specifically on defense, like they weren't trying to tackle or anything.
No, it was awful from the word go. They Todd Bowles, the head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, blitzed them 75% of the time in the first half. It's like. I always joke around, you know, I was with the guys on the set of Breakfast Ball, and they were like, you know, Malik Nabers is mad because, you know, he said, hey, they didn't give me the ball until the fourth quarter, and, you know, we need to start the ball, getting the ball in my hands. And I always joke around, the further you get away from the football, the less you actually know about the game. I go, why do you think a wide receiver didn't get the ball early? Because you're peeling the quarterback up off the turf every freaking play. They brought pressure. They jammed. They played man-to-man, brought pressure on just about on every 75% of the plays. They sacked him four times in the first half. They had him under duress the whole game. There's a reason you didn't get the ball, moron, because the quarterback couldn't throw the ball. Like it blows me away that you don't understand how the game works. 10 of the guys have to do their job for you to sniff the football. And when they're bringing pressure and you guys can't block them, you're not going to get the ball. Like the fact that it was an epiphany that all of a sudden in the fourth quarter, Malik Nabers, you started getting the ball, when they called off the dogs, yeah, you did start getting the ball. Like, come on, you guys. This is, it's ridiculous.
Mark, you've been through this before. You've had a lot of surgeries knee-wise, and we see what happened to Taysom Hill, ACL tear and other parts, too, that need to be repaired with him. 34 years old. We've talked to some of the orthopedic surgeons that they didn't perform or weren't going to perform the surgery, but they tell us this is a, you know, a 10 to 11 month recovery time for Taysom. You being a player that has went through a lot of that, the mental part of coming back from that is much more difficult than the physical part. And especially as you're 34 going to be 35 years old, that becomes a challenge too. But if anybody can do it, it's Taysom Hill.
Yeah, well, we've talked about his athleticism, his freak show athleticism and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I don't have any doubt that he'll cruise through the rehab part of it and the surgery part of it. And it's a much less invasive surgery, you know, than when I had my ACL back in the 80s. Like, it's completely different from that aspect. So guys are really popping back and healing quicker. And you're right, though, the mental aspect of it, you know, the feeling like, hey, man, it's not quite right, or, you know, it's a little bit sore, and sometimes it's, you know, one step forward, you feel great, you work out really hard, and then you're, you know, you feel like you're back to square one, and those things are frustrating, and those things, you know, take time to get over and all that kind of stuff. So the mental aspect of it is really the toughest part. And one of the things that I always tell guys that are going through that is, like, you've got to understand, because you get out of the surgery, and what will the surgeon say? Hey, man, it was a successful surgery. That'll be the first thing they say. Like, hey, man, I did my job.
You know, now you do yours.
Yeah, you never heard a surgeon come out and go, yeah, we kind of screwed that one up. Didn't really work out very well. But, you know, I think you'll walk again. So, like, you're forever altered. And I tell this to guys all the time. You'll never be the same. Now, maybe you'll be better. That could happen. But you'll never be the same. It will always feel different. And I go, the thing you have to be able to do is set whatever your new 100% is. And, you know, it may be 70 or 80% of what it used to be. But it's still good enough for you to be a great, great football player. And for me, when I had my ACL in college, you know, it really took for me to really become good again and to have confidence again. I moved from the defensive side of the ball back over to the offensive side of the ball. And that's when I regained my confidence in my ability. And so, you know, for every guy, it's different. But I've always just said, hey, set whatever. When you get to the point where you're medically cleared, you go out to play, that's my new 100%. And like I said, it may be 80% of what it used to be. But I am good enough and I'm healed well enough to go ahead and stress this thing and play. And then just see where it can go from there. And if it gets better, then it's gravy. But at least you can set yourself mentally up to play and to understand that even though I'm not what I once was, I can still really play and I can still really be good and I can really be effective. And oftentimes that's where the mentality and the mental aspect of the game, the football acumen aspect of the game, really increases for players like it did for me. Because now all of a sudden you're like, well, I got to make up for whatever athletic ability I lost, I've got to make up for that by being smarter than I used to be when it comes to playing this game. And so there are some benefits to it. We'll see exactly how he responds, but I would expect him to be full go next year and not miss a beat because the guy is a freak show.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Man, always enjoy having you on. And what game you got this weekend?
I'm off this weekend. Okay. Next weekend, I'm in Jacksonville.
Oh, okay. May they give you the big game, right? The Jaguars.
Yeah, the Jags. It's going to be a great one.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it, partner.
Thanks, Mark.
You got it, man.
All right. That was Odyssey NFL Insider Mark Schlereff, host of the Stinkin' Truth podcast. Insider calls are brought to you by Hellman's Real Mayonnaise. May your game day be delicious. We come back, be triple option right here on the Big 870 WWL. Back here on Sports Talk on the Big 870, Mike Dettelia along with Steve Geller, Charlie Long. It's our triple option feature. Steve, you go first.
Well, guys, today I heard one of the most ridiculous things for sports being proposed in Major League Baseball. The golden at-bat rule is being discussed by Commissioner Rob Manfred and would theoretically allow teams to put one at-bat per game to their preferred hitter rather than following the batting order. Manfred says that there is a little buzz around it at owners' meetings, but noted things are in the conversation-only stage right now, thank goodness. But Manfred has overseen some other rule changes we know of, like the pitch clock, the ghost runner in extra innings. The golden at-bat, though, I feel like that would change things very dramatically in games, and I am not for it at all. I think it's a ridiculous proposal to have. You know, you can just insert your best batter in any situation one time a game.
Yeah, I was talking to Cullen about this, and that, Steve, you took mine, so I'm going to have to figure
oh,
one out.
No,
so, Mike,
sorry.
Mike, you have to go after this one. But Cullen and I were talking about this, guys. It's the dumbest thing. Like, it's not even being over-exaggerated how stupid this rule would be. Like, it's just, it's to get stars in big moments. I understand that. But, I mean, the whole point of baseball is it's a team game, right? Like, 1 through 9 in the lineup has to contribute. 10 guys on the field have to contribute. It's not just one player coming up.
Seems like a circus show to me right there.
Yeah, it's stupid. Yeah. So, I don't know. I agree with you, Steve. I think it's really dumb.
Jaden Daniels continues to write history in the NFL. And in Week 13, Jaden Daniels became the first rookie quarterback in NFL history to reach the following in one game. He completed 80% of his passes, 3 passing touchdowns, 1 rushing touchdown. And he also became the first rookie since 1970, the NFL-AFL merger, with 3 games of 20-plus pass attempts and 80% completion rates. Think of that. And people, man, I don't know if Jaden can compute this at the NFL level and be a big-time passer. He's proven you wrong.
All right, guys, I found out what I'm going to go with, and I'm going to be my homer self because he's a former UL Raging Cajun. The Pelicans waving Elfrid Payton today. Sad.
Mike would say boo.
What? I don't know, guys. It's a little unfortunate. Hopefully,
you'll be back one day.
Yeah, I'm not understanding that one. They need all the help they can right now.
The only way I can really understand it is if they're getting some help back soon, which it seems like Herb Jones is supposedly coming back very soon. But they also moved a couple guys to the G League, like Carlo Mackovich and Antonio Reeves. So, I mean, they have the space available. I don't really know why they would waive, you know, someone that was contributing at a decent level for you off the bench. Elfrid Payton is basically a week removed from that game against the Pacers where he had 21 assists. I don't know, guys. It just seems kind of dumb to me. On the season with the Pelicans, he averaged about 6.7 points, 6.7 assists, and 3.4 rebounds. It's still a contributing piece to a team that's been obviously banged up all season long, but they decided to waive him. I don't really get it.
Guys, I said this last night on Sports Talk, and I told this to Bob. I don't see how Willie Green survives this into January. I really don't.
Even with all the injuries?
Even with all the injuries. Man, there's a certain part of apathy that people really don't care anymore.
Willie Green's part of the problem, right? But I don't.
But
think
he's going to be the guy they throw under the guillotine.
He is probably the fall guy, but at the same time, it's like, I mean, you get rid of Willie Green, James Borrego probably takes over at that point. But what does that really do for you? You know what I mean? Yes, he's probably going to end up being the fall guy, but the Pelicans have a lot of issues, and I don't know.
We don't have enough time to go through them all.
Yeah, exactly. Sure.
We'll be back with more Sports Talk here on the Big 870 right after this break. Finishing up here in hour number 2 of Sports Talk on the Big 870, Mike DeTeglia, Steve Geller, Charlie Long. In the 6 o'clock hour, we'll have Zach Nagy on talking about LSU Tigers. And at 7 o'clock, it'll be the voice of the Saints for the Saints Hour with Executive Vice President, General Manager Mickey Loomis, and also Mike will talk to Jeff Ireland, Jim Nagy, and also Moose Johnson about the Saints Giants. We'll have more here on the Big 870 WWL right after this news break.